So it feels like you can have that kind of feeling of, like, there's no orientation. So that is spacey, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah, I mean, what orientation could you practically give your present experience if you're not conjuring that orientation through, right, through ideas? And the actual experience, whatever that implies, it's not that difficult to see that whatever experience is or isn't is happening of its own accord and is not accompanied by, you know, any story. That you could say just that simple observation, you know, as it goes, let's say, courses more deeply through your soul, is itself liberation. I mean, why do they write all that shit that they wrote about it? It seems absurd. Here's present experience. It's not telling a story, but it's irrefutable in the way that it is irrefutable or felt. I am for sure not controlling it. And I don't have anything to say about it. That's liberation.
But at the same time, the habit to, like, make comments rages on.
Yeah, sure. Raging. Yeah, absolutely. The raging on rages on. Yeah.
It's like listening to a giant Teddy Ruxpin. That's how I was feeling myself the other day. I'm like a giant storytelling Teddy Ruxpin. You know, a little bear with talk.
Yeah.
I love you.
Yeah. I'm a real boy.
Do you have any spare drugs?
That's why Teddy Ruxpin says.
I really love you. My hands don't work. Can you light that up? I'm just a teddy bear.
Yeah. So the raging on is, yeah, that's not about to go anywhere. But you know what? You could say is entrapping is not the raging on itself, but it's the addiction to it. It's the urgency to derive meaning, context, or content for self. That's what's entrapping. If, you know, Peter makes this comment somewhat frequently. The raging on, think of the raging on, you know, as a crazy aunt sitting in the corner of the living room that just blabbers out, you know, inanities and abuses you all day long. But after a while, you don't pay her any mind. You get her a cup of tea, make sure she has a bologna sandwich for lunch, and then you'll see her after work. But we, you could say, personalize the raging on as being my raging on, or that it's somehow now important, or, you know, or that it's giving us, like, meaningful, articulate feedback. And so we'd better pay attention to our own hallucination. That's what you could say is entrapping.
It's like taking your Teddy Ruxpin seriously.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. For instance, you know, let's say the Russians mounted an attack on the shores of Alaska, and you pulled a string on your Teddy Ruxpin to figure out what your strategy should be. And it's perfectly okay that, you know, so-called every creature goes through life paying attention to their own Teddy Ruxpin, even though it's completely untrue and it's fabricated. You could say it creates a certain sense of you know, what would you call it, comfort or familiarity, that I keep applying this, you know, completely abstract overlay to the fact of experiencing and create ad nauseum context and content. And that becomes defining of my experience and I presume defining of the experience of so-called other people. And that's the illusion or the delusion through which one's life, you know, merrily races toward the grave. And that's cool. You know, no one is going to get into any kind of alarm about that fallacy unless, you know, one or several things occur in their life to remind them that they ought to reconsider the implications of their own imagination. And that's why this is, you know, let's say steep or marginally popular. Because not that many folks, you know, are really interested or thrilled, at the invitation to reconsider the, you know, the structure and the implication of their own consciousness. They're convinced that their Teddy Ruxpin speaks truth.
True stories.
True stories. No.
True stories to satisfy your inner child.
That's right. Yeah, you know, or to rage on. It really is so remarkably uncomplicated. We, you know, we use all of these, you could call them avoidance and deferral tactics to continue to prove to others and ourselves that our mind, our thoughts, our context, and our content is real, is legitimate, is verifiable, is bona fide. But it's not. It's just not. And so we want our, you know, our spiritual or secular lives to resolve to our satisfaction through the neurosis of this imagined creature. That's why I go to, you know, healers and channelers and ascended masters and places like Pebble Hill and the Being One Center so that I can get messages that give me an advantage to either avoid pain or to attract, you know, good times. Astrologers. It's a lot simpler, though, maybe not so satisfying in the initial stages. You know, to feel what it feels like to give up the appetite for all implication.
Yeah, for me, I feel like I always just end up like giving up as like an action. And it's like, oh no, that's like just some other fucking game I'm playing.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, see, like the raging on is so interesting because it is capable of, let's say, fooling you or soliciting your attention ongoingly. And it'll tell you a story about a story about a story, even the story of, you know, getting beyond stories. That's how good it is.
You have a desire to be like unencumbered by desires. It's just like one more good one.
Yeah, because, you know, that you are encumbered is a myth. That there is desire is a myth. That you could come out on the other end being unencumbered by desire is another is another myth. It's another myth of context, content, and implication, which itself creates a sense of, you know, an individuated creature in time.
But I feel like I'm able to, like, strip all that away and just say, all right, no time, none of this shit, just random shit appearing. Some things appearing we call desires, but there essentially could be in my mind an existence where these weren't appearing. And that's, like, the goal to strive for, regardless of it being, you know, another, like, thought in my mind anyway. Yeah,
that's right. That's right. And you know, a clever, meaning an engaged mind, right, that is peering into the nature of consciousness itself, into the texture of consciousness itself, will find, you know, what you just described. It can find that. It can find subtle objects that feel like desire or impulse like desire, a sense of self that is encumbered by desire, and the glorious imagination of a sense of self that is unencumbered by desire. Yeah, I mean, it can and does create anything at all. With, you could say, random abandon. And these are objects, right? Each one of these, think of them as, you know, cardinal points of association or cardinal points of implication. They're all ghosts. They're all ghosts. And each cardinal point that's found in awareness or found in consciousness implies the finder. And that there is an object found that implies a finder is, you could say, what implication is made of. Because in the finding of an object, seen, felt, heard, and responded to, that is the movement of psychological time. And psychological time is no different than what we call the sense of being an individuated self. So time, self, implication, individuation is all inexorably woven into what we call objects appearing in consciousness. It's really quite miraculous. I mean, it's kind of a beautiful, you know, system if you look at it, you know, somewhat mathematically without all of the emotional tremors, right? If there's no emotional tremors associated with what we call mind, then it's like, how elegant. Wow, that's just incredible. Space, time, self, implication, objects, consciousness, subject are all the same thing. They're all exactly the same, call it thing or no thing. It's like, wow, that's just really fucking beautiful. But when we, you know, apply emotivity, sentimentality, the disappointments and insults that life will, you know, invariably gift us with, well, then we can have a negative association with the majesty of consciousness itself. And then we want to get out from under. You know, not be a party to it. Find liberation by, you know, resisting attraction and aversion. But that's impossible to do. Because once you're in attraction and aversion, or you're being, can you say, floated, you know, on the shit stream of attraction and aversion, you're too late because the weave of individuation is already too strong. And then we get lost in a mind that says, well, I'm suffering because I'll suffer less if I, and then I'll apply myself to, and boy, I'm not doing such a great job applying myself after I committed over and over again to myself that I would be better at eating, meditating, bathing, yoga, you know, calling my sponsor. And I just can't seem to get my shit together. Ever.
Yeah, I feel like what it looked like for me was that, you know, that sort of starts happening, right? And then all of the, like, positive life benefits start happening on their own. And it's like, oh, this is good. This is good. Keep doing this. We want more of this. This is like, you know, these were the effects that weren't, you know, sought, but now have been gained. And now we're going to, like, you know, naturally begin trying to gain some more of them. And it was just like, and we're derailed again.
Yeah, that's nice. That's right. Derailed again. Yeah, the name of the train that I always get on is Derailed. Really. Off the tracks again. And as we, let's say, investigate or consider the miraculous nature of consciousness doing what it does, and it kind of makes perfect sense that it should always derail. I mean, it's just random noise. Any object found that becomes contextual or contentual is a lie. Is untrue. So therefore, any kind of commitment or belief or structure that's happening in consciousness is going to, you know, ideally fail and derail. And that's another, you know, really lovely pointer of, you know, the fact that this is liberated. It doesn't obey anything.
It's like I had the other day, or I was thinking, so the idea, like, just the, I have a life at all is an idea that I will die, I was born, all that stuff. And so it's funny because you think a life is, like, so precious, you know, and you're like, I can't understand why consciousness would be fucking shit up so crazily.
Yeah.
Then it's like, well, if it's just an idea, like, everything's just kind of an imagination. You're like, you can see your own thoughts are like, I'll be seriously thinking of something and then something happens and I completely forget about it. It's like, what? I'm sorry, what? Because if it's just dreaming, then it's a very different, it's like, well, I can see how I just, you know, dreaming and then squirrel and then dreaming and squirrel, you know?
Yep.
Like,
yep. Yeah, that's, you know, we're flitting about in streaming daydream. And we're, you could say, capable of having a task orientation, which includes priority setting and discernment and inputs and conversations and emails and memos and motor control and repetitive or novel ways to assemble things. And we can, you know, go to the moon or even pretend to go to the moon. They're the same great feat. Whether you actually got there or pretended to get there is like fantastic. What you did.
Yeah, I think that was Neil deGrasse Tyson. He's like, it would be harder to fake the moon landing than to have gone to the moon.
Yeah, would have been, yeah, just easier to get there, actually, than to pretend. Mm-hmm. You know, resting in presence or resting as presence, you know, all the seekers are like, yeah, yeah, rah, rah, sis, boom, bah. And you can say as it actually unfurls for you, you know, it may not be as exciting or enthralling or effervescent as you might have hoped it would be. It really is its own, it's its own, I mean, it's not human. Mitochondria is not human. Human's not human. Resting in presence is not human. We sometimes, you know, look to things like liberation or whatever as to be amelioratives or satisfiers for our vagueness and our confusion and our suffering and all the shit that we can't stand. But what if it is, you know, operating, let's say, on a bandwidth that really has nothing to do with the resolution of the imagination of someone's life? Well, then you really have to get used to it on very different terms than the lust that we had for enlightenment to be resolving of our suffering.
Which, like, that has to be stagnant to some extent, because once you've taken the idea of a person in a world and then built on top of it,
yep,
at the core of that is a stagnation. It's a person in a world, and that's yep, solidified into, it's going to be a putrid kind of.
Yeah, the stagnation is, that's right. The stagnation is disappointing. It's kind of like, you know, we know what chocolate tastes like, and let's say if we like chocolate, then we know that we can turn to chocolate to have a certain kind of, you know, satisfying experience or interlude or addiction, which is fine too. No biggie. And so we turn to, let's say, something like, you know, so-called enlightenment or liberation in the same way that we would turn to chocolate, that it would be some kind of a familiar satisfier or destination or homecoming of, or something like that for the likes of my consciousness. But what if it's not? What if it's operating, you know, absolutely on its own set of train tracks, that it turns out not to be an ameliorative? It could be, you know, let's say the end of a certain quality of stagnation. That doesn't mean you're going to necessarily enjoy it. See, what happens if the, call it the myth and the inertia of the enjoyer or the sufferer, you know, just goes into abeyance. You go out trick-or-treating and you come home with an empty pumpkin head. I didn't get that one piece of candy.
Toothpaste. You know, those people, you only went to the house where you got toothpaste.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Here's a sample tube of Colgate. Thanks.
That was better from where I was from, man. People gave out like razor blades and apples and shit. It was fucked up.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Here's a lit M80. Honey, close the door.
You need toothpaste and razor blades, you know, and chocolate. We're just
blowing up trick-or-treaters left and right. Yeah. It's just, it's real fun, I find, to, you know, discover what it feels like to drop your mind off at the Y. Just drop your mind off at the Y and then go for a joyride without it. Then this, you know, that urgency to resolve and to figure out and to justify and to describe and to create future and, you know, pursue fulfillingness. All of that just gone. It's just gone. And the urgency for, you know, coming up with more content and more context for your present experience, that's gone too. you know, you find a, call it a place, though it's not a place, or a quality of, you know, resting or of contemplation, if you want to call it that, object-free, stress-free contemplation. And you can't make any claim about it. You can't make any claim about for yourself as having, you know, being the acquirer or the accomplisher of something. It's really nice when the myth of future just disappears. I guess we're always so driven by, you know, the myth of future. What's going to be experienced? How can I make it better? How can I avoid it? If I anticipate it'll be unpleasant. How can I manipulate my way in and to into and out of
anything and everyone that comes into
yeah, it's just, that's right. I mean, it's an ongoing battlefield of, you know, manipulation and strategizing. Yeah, it's just, and it's, you know, if you want to value it, you can say it's perhaps wonderful that you can be alive, whatever that means, without the burden of having a future or having to fulfill one. And that same, you could say, quality of relaxation, you know, relieves us of the antagonism of guilt or the antagonism of victimization, you know, having to resolve the stickiness of human affairs, the drama of things spoken and unspoken. If there is something that could be called freedom, well, it had better be this. Because if it's not this, what the fuck else could it possibly be?
One of the sticks my mind always had was like, hey, if this could be fooled into some sort of illusion or delusion, who's to say that you can really ever undo all of that? And as if there's some place where that's not another illusion or delusion.
Sure. Well played. But you'll notice that in order to come up with that as a plausible, you know, tautology, those are objects, right? Those are referential objects that wonder aloud about the plausibility of, you know, being, let's say, condemned to delusion for the long haul. And never, you know, being, quote, able to wiggle out of it. So you have to first construct the delusion, you're basically defining the delusion into existence and then deciding or choosing for yourself whether you can be, you know, unencumbered by that delusion or forever under its sway. But in order to do that, you first have to find objects, implication, consciousness, delusion, something that might be other than delusion. And if none of those are true, then it's like, well, what of it? It's like your natural, say, resting place is, well, you could say it's beyond delusion or the absence of delusion. When nothing is defined into being as having any possible influence over anything else, then what? I'm sorry, delusion? What? And it does leave you with, let's just say, the infallibility of your own present experience. And so you're left, you could say, having to explore the infallibility of your own present experience and see what you make of it.
Yeah, I guess that ultimately just comes back to like playing more games where you're trying to rearrange this experience.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like that's what's happening regardless of even if you don't want it to. Again, it's like, oh, I can just be calm and let it all happen. But it's like, that's just like another thing I'm now doing.
You know? Yep, yep. You see, it's just one object after another that places you in the so-called driver's seat or the recipient seat of what to do with or what to do about. Which is, you know, cool. That's what mind is, right? It always pretends that there's something that one should do with or about something else, maybe including itself. And so it lays the fabric, you know, ongoingly for the delusion of delusion. That there could possibly be delusion, or that there could possibly be the absence of said delusion.
I guess I can see the utility then of just going somewhere other than your mind with your attention.
Yeah.
So like, oh, just be in your body or do this, just to like sort of interrupt this mind stream, you know, so to speak.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and then that's fun to play with. So let's say it's like, okay, so where am I now? What is my attention interested in now? And you can like, you can see that you can't actually figure it out. It's like if you look into the basket, let's say your attention is a beautiful, you know, basket woven by meticulous, you know, Native American hands of incredible materials. So that's consciousness, right? It's a basket. You look into the basket to see what's in your attention. And all you'll find is another object, another idea. And no matter what you find, that so-called in your attention is also going to be late. If you find an object, you're late. And that object is not actually in the basket of attention. Attention is emptiness itself. That's kind of fun. By thinking that attention is an object, or that it belongs to you, or that you belong to it, and that objects or subjects or whatever appear in attention as if it were some kind of a volume or a container, is, right, more objects found. Yeah. I mean, they're lovely objects. They're subtle, right? And subtlety is, you know, part of the name of this game. If the mind can't fool you with, you know, gross blood splattering all over the place, which is how most minds function, then it's like, oh, well, I can't seem to hook, you know, Ryan's attention by creating, you know, unmanageable dramas 24/7. So I know I'll get him by, you know, conjuring like subtle emanations. And then he'll feel like he's discovered something.
You ideological, like you in an ideological scene. That's like all that mine keeps doing. I'm like, oh, look, it's me in another ideological scene. I'm so shocked. You know? Oh, thanks, Teddy.
Yeah.
My pleasure.
Hey, is this another story about me?
This is the unraveling of what appears as content and context. What appears as content and context, attracting or unfolding in so-called awareness, and the discovery that that's not actually occurring.
Yeah, that seemed to be like a almost perfect description of the game being played here, I guess. It was like, oh, all sorts of like magical shit happened. And then I was like, oh, with all these symptoms. And then like, oh, there's a new setting, a new stage, mm-hmm. you know, like stream of bullshit to mm-hmm. and make, you know, I don't know, make madness out of, I guess.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, it's a Molotov cocktail, you know, it's identity, subjectivity, objects, attention, consciousness, awareness, implication, time, space, coordinates. It's like, wow, how did all that happen so quickly and so impersonally without, you know, any willful intervention and be able to be so captivating that I find myself as the product of anything at all? It's amazing. Think of it as a, you know, as kind of a pulse field of captivation. And it's got all this stuff at its disposal to captivate you with. I mean, the five senses, right, can captivate you one at a time, all together, right? Mind and ideation, subjectivity, physical sensation, space-time, implication. It's just, you could say, streaming captivation. And that's suffering. Samsara is made of the streaming nature of what we're calling captivation. Because it's the captivation that is the, let's just say, the fuse for what we call, you know, the sense of I am. Without being captivated, the I am just disappears. I mean, kind of remarkably quickly. Because if I'm not being captivated, then, you know, I just doesn't make any sense. It's like saying way too much. But
Can you hear me?
Yeah. But I makes, you could say, kind of organic sense to at least us, our way, our conditioned way of being, you know, through the, call it the majesty of unceasing captivation.
The captivation in a story is so pervasive that sometimes you feel totally lost in the story.
That's captivation. You know? But that is captivation. Yeah, daydreaming is captivation.
But
mindfulness is captivation.
Where's the
There is.
But is there?
There is no I am. There's no I am at all. Unless captivation has, you know, let's say, solicited your attention and you feel as if you're finding things.
But even in captivation, there seems to be less I am in captivation than there can be. It's more like self-reflection, you know, where.
Well, anything that's appearing at all. Anything that's appearing at all, regardless of the mood, regardless of the fondness of its contemplative, you know, cheerfulness, is another symptom of captivation. You can find many, many degrees, but it's just captivation. And it's by virtue of being captivated by whatever that the I am feels justified in, you know, trumpeting its existence. There is no, I would argue, just for fun, there is no I am that exists or can be pointed to outside of the miracle of being captivated, of captivation. Because your fundamental nature, if I can be so bold, is objectless. And if you see the objectlessness of so-called present experience, which is no experience at all, well, then even the, you know, the rogue sense of I am is also not present. We think, if I can do this, not do that, meditate this way, not that way, eat this, not that, you know, follow a certain, you know, non-dual strategy of some kind, that I can outwit the streaming nature of captivation. But hoping to find anything at all that's an ameliorative or better than or less than, quieter than, more peaceful than, more enlightened than, less enlightened than. Trying to find anything at all that's other than exactly what this is at present is, you could say, captivation. And that immediately suggests, you know, an I am, whether embodied or otherwise, in time.
Well, you know, the captivation idea, that it seems to me that there'd be some other description that might serve better. When, I mean, like I said, I can be, I feel like there's this greater sense of I am upon some kind of reflection. It may or may not be there, because captivation could be watching a TV show or a movie or something, being totally enraptured with it. And I don't know that I don't know where that sense of I am is in that happening. I mean, there's a lot of examples where you can be captivated and you're not necessarily really thinking about, there's not that sense of I am in the same way as there are in other mental states.
Of course, understood. You know, if you're being entertained by some kind of media and that has you engaged or enthralled, you know, in one way or another, then that's a form of captivation. But even in, let's say, a more subtle, contemplative environment where there's no TV, no radio, you're not running around, you're not reading anything, listening to a YouTube, you are just, you know, chilling, unadorned. Lying down, sitting up, walking, whatever the hell it is. You're just unadorned. If there's nothing to be captivated by, then what I'm suggesting is there's no sense of I am. Now what may be present is, you could say, you know, curiosity itself, wonder itself, intelligence itself, radiant presence, if you like that terminology. And you could also call it I am. But see, any moniker that you would give it, again, creates the, you know, the hallucination of your being captivated by something. See? The moment you assign, you know, a phrase or a moniker or a mnemonic device to so-called experience, then you're back in the, under the influence of captivation.
What's the difference between the rising of I am and the rising of consciousness? Where is there?
What, if you strip away the names, those two name forms, could you say what it is that you're referring to? It's not a test.
Yeah, I know. Well, yeah, consciousness is particularly difficult because, you know, I take it as sort of a second second level type thing. It's like,
okay,
more like an awareness. It's like you're conscious of your what you do. You're conscious of your thoughts.
But right. Thoughts, and that's, and that, you know, let's say appreciation of consciousness for the sake of this conversation is just another figment of imagination. You're creating the hallucination of time through, right, so-called comparative analysis using terminology. And even if you got, you know, closer in, let's say, than consciousness, what would you call that? What's closer in than consciousness? Would you be comfortable calling that I am?
No, I never quite got the I am thing anyway.
I mean,
I see that sometimes it's more of almost a psychological thing. It's like that. The questions about the commander and the brain, that sort of thing.
Okay, so would you, is there a word, and you can even use one that you've never used before or make one up if you want to talk in tongues, that you would refer to as this that is not adorned before it's, you know, consciousness?
I don't think I have a sound. How about om?
Okay. Yeah. And then strip away the word. And what are we left with?
Just a vibe.
Yeah, that's right. Just a vibe. Yeah. Yeah. And if you trace the vibe, if you follow the vibe, it gets very interesting.
Well, is the idea of focusing on the I am, is the idea of that so that the I am just finally gives up on itself?
Well, sure, but and that you could say that strategy, let's say that's a yogic strategy, whether deliberate or accidental, right? Let's say that that's the same thing as we just mentioned. Follow the vibe. Follow the bouncing ball. Follow or attend to, whatever that suggests, the most subtle vibe that you can find. And this, I would say, rather scintillating you know, flowing or streaming, or even if you want to call it staccato, nature of simply being attendant to the vibe is its own, let's say, intelligence. You know, calling it attention, awareness, consciousness, I am, the absolute, that all seems, right, somewhat silly. Because if you strip away the word forms and the name forms, as you so adroitly pointed out, oh my goodness, I'm really made out of vibe. And I am, you could say, the energy and texture of vibe, grooving on vibe itself. And I don't have, you know, words, explicit words for that. I don't need them.
Well, and I think there lies the other confusion to take some of these instructions that we get from the masters about dwelling on the I am. Because, you know, it's a symbology, you know. And, I mean, it's anyway to me.
Yes, the symbology easily distracts or captivates our attention, may I say, away from the simplicity of vibe itself, and yeah, again, conjures an allegorical world.
Yeah, I mean, something like that, which is, to me, curious that that's like the instruction that you get.
Well, most instruction sucks. And most instruction is, you know, you could say geared toward or compromised by the demand or the expectation of the instructionee of, you know, call it the student role. Because the student, any of us, are, you know, demanding succor, relief, enlightenment, explanation, right? Something to belong to, dues paying, right? Equal representation, right? The demand that the so-called student body or conformist reality places on, you know, the quote teacher, you could say forces the teacher's hand. That was, you know, apparently what tripped the Buddha up, right? His first impulse, if we can borrow from that silly story again, was, I'm not saying anything to anybody because there's nothing here. But the demand from the suffering minions that came to the Buddha for succor and justification, explanation, and a course or path of study, you could say drew from him, right, the, call it the most compassionate response he could give. Even though that response ended up reinforcing or enrolling people in the continuity of the imagination of their own misery. That's why, you know, the story of Ramakrishna was that he kept a copy of the Ashtavakra Gita, you know, under his pillow. Only a devotee that was crazy enough to steal it from under his sleeping head would be eligible to get it. Bite their fingers off. So it's remarkable that, you know, call it the non-dual or direct instruction. And direct instruction is really just more like friendship, right? There's no instruction. It's just like, vibe on, dude. It's more like Ninja Turtles. Yeah. Right? Direct instruction is more like a, you know, a vibratory friendship. Whereas the other so-called forms of instruction are, I would argue, they're somewhat less intimate, and they festoon one, you know, on an imaginary allegorical island with only one album and no record player. Frustrating place to be.
I always kind of felt that with TM, you know.
Sure. Yeah. It was all lies. Lies all the way down. Yeah. And yet there's, you know, in anything there's still, what could you say, the remarkable signature of the, you know, cogent or irrational nature of reality. You can't escape reality. Even if you're, you know, captivated to the point of, you know, homicide or captivated to the point of suicide, you can't escape reality. Discovering its, you know, vibratory or vibing nature and weaning oneself from the weaning oneself from the inertial pull of becoming, of time. That's the lovely dance of, you know, this kind of yoga.
Yeah.
Follow the vibe. Vibe is what it's following vibe. It's not like consciousness looking at something that's other than consciousness, or awareness that's considering anything that's other than awareness. And that's where the, right, the myth of the so-called duality fortunately breaks down. One's, you know, one's, you could say, field is non-dual. Your field, whoa, which would be the inclusivity of, let's say, all and everything, as if there were things, is non-dual. You're no longer holding yourself out or apart as an individuated packet of consciousness or awareness or intentionality, making discoveries that can then, you know, benefit you and, you know, harm your enemies. That whole myth of being, of this being other than itself is starting to, you know, break down. This is not other than itself. And that's the release from the, you know, the imagination of so-called duality.
You say this is none other than self? Is that what you said?
Yeah, this is never other than itself. And this means what? Well, emptiness and form, you know. If you have to call it anything, if it has to appear, you know, as, you know, the tension or the sweetness of opposites. The bhakti yogi doesn't want to actually merge with God because that would be the end of the love affair.
Yeah.
Love affair only is, you know, thrilling when there's that, you know, still lingering separation between the adored and the adorer. When, you know, Ramakrishna was assailed by Totapuri by sticking a piece of glass in his third eye, you know, literally. That's when, you know, the bliss of Ramakrishna's, you know, bhakti was broken. And he, you know, from a yogic perspective, merged, right? That was the finality of his seventh chakra opening. Do you want to play those games? But see, all of this stuff is just, I mean, it's luscious in one respect, and it's kind of maddening and useless in in another respect.
Yeah.
You meet a lot of people over the years that love Ramakrishna, love Ramana Maharshi, love Nirsagadatta, love Amichi. It goes on and on and on and on, you know. And they'll profess and profound and read and get excited and da-da-da-da-da. And it's like, phew, hey, why don't you just wake the fuck up? You know what I mean? Just wake the fuck up. You can, okay, it's very nice that you've, you know, gotten 30 hugs from Amichi and you bought 18 of her chocolate dolls and 50 coconuts and, you know, you're a contributor to her hospital where they steal kidneys and sell them on the black market. You know, that's great. Fantastic. Relieved from the, you know, psychic pressure of becoming or the pressure of explanation, justification, you know, unraveling why things are the way that I imagine them to be and what I can do about them. It's just all of that myth, all of that swamp, you know, swampy myth just gone. We hunger, let's say, for reality because we're suffering from the illusion of unreality. And if we find ourselves no longer suffering from the illusion or delusion of unreality, then where are we going? This is more right of an erasure than, you know, anything found. Because the erasure, you could say, relieves and relaxes you from the pressure of consciousness itself on the lookout for something different or something better or something that's more real or makes more sense. The erasure just, well, brings you back to innocence.
The interesting thing is that despite that, there seems to be the whether you call it ego or drive or whatever, this energy that wants to get into shit, you know?
I hear you. That's why I refer to it, you know, let's say simply and inclusively as captivation.
Yeah.
Yeah. Captivation is, yeah, hey, there's something to do. Something to do about something.
Yeah, and it may be miserable, but somehow we'll go right to the misery. It doesn't matter.
It doesn't. Yeah, it doesn't. Yeah.
It's this, maybe it's a greater sense of self in that.
Well,
it seems to me that the most suffering is where there's a, you know, sense of self in things.
Self, agency, time. Yeah. It all conjures instantaneously.
Yeah.
It's impossible to pick apart let's call it the unfriendly elements of captivation to hopefully leave only the fond elements of captivation. That's where people get, if there were any people, stuck in the ongoing, you know, hallucination of through prioritization, through discrimination, through whatever means, I'm going to free myself from the afflictive qualities of captivation and then benefit spiritually or perhaps financially, which it seems so common these days, from the glorious elements of captivation. And then I will sell my personal story and my methodology for assisting you in ridding yourself of the unpleasant elements of captivation, and then only to find the glorious elements of captivation so that perhaps you could make an enviable living too. So it turns out to be kind of an MLM scam. No, it's a pyramid scam. It's a very different game.
Well, things keep... Mm-hmm. Things keep changing, you know, so you think you got a fix on it, and you have a way of, you know, the positive parts of just getting into things, and or the captivation, and then the scene changes, you know? And here you are doing things that you thought would be good, and you're kind of not very enamored of it anymore, you know?
Well, that is the, well, let's say the ongoing inevitability of the myth of captivation.
Yeah.
That's why the Buddha said dukkha, you know? It's unsatisfactory.
Yeah.
Because we're just, you know, shifting from, you know, let's say one temporal illusion field to the next temporal illusion field, and working really hard to keep the imagination of content and context going so that we can stay in the game as, you know, an independent agent.
Yeah.
Agency and captivation, they're the same. So it's useful, my bias, let's say, is that it's useful to see all of this stuff that we can enumerate, segregate with language, with sentiment, and with subtlety, to appreciate that, oh shit, I thought it was a million things, but it's only one thing. Captivation, agency, time, objects, consciousness, they are not many things. They are just this. It makes it a lot simpler to rid oneself of the beckoning and the influence of captivation by appreciating that everything that appears is of the nature of captivation. Is of the nature of this, say, primacy of unsatisfactoriness.
Well,
could
you say that that's because we're making it all personal? In other words,
hang on. See, that's another illusory element. Personal is this. Personal is captivation.
Right.
It's all included.
That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, what is that, the... Second, you know, those three things, you know, the impersonal is the one of those three, the temporary nature. And then I forget the third.
Well, it's anicca, dukkha, anicca, anatta.
You know, anicca
is the impermanence. Dukkha is the unsatisfactoriness. Anatta is the revelation of not self. Or anatta.
Yeah.
Depending on where you place the emphasis. Yeah.
I mean, there's so many ways to look at this. Obviously.
Yeah. Right. Go to your local New Age bookstore.
Oh, man. And we've got so many words.
How do I love myself? Let me count the ways. I love myself. I love myself not. I love myself. I love myself not. I'll rip up a whole field of roses. So you could say there's this, to the, let's say, extent that our so-called consciousness can embrace the full field of permutation, helps us to relax from the full field of permutation. Because if we're negotiating or navigating objects or elements in the field, we're fucked. You'll be busy for lifetimes and lifetimes negotiating with and navigating what appear as discrete elements. So a mind that's then capable of embracing, oh boy, I mean the entire catastrophe, that mind is then capable of wiggling, you could say, free from the implication of that catastrophe, because it's no longer suffering from discrimination. Even though discrimination is used as a way of not suffering, I can also use discrimination as being, overwhelmed by finding elements and elements and elements and elements which keep referring to self, 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 and self. And the, you could say the motive to be free from self, from self, from self, from self, from self, from self. Everything's in an echo chamber. I. Can't. Stand. Myself, self. See? It's just echoing. We usually try, you know, the seeker's dilemma is that we're trying on a myopic scale to rid ourselves of certain elements and to maintain or, right, emphasize or enhance other elements, because we think that this is many things. It's not many things. And the appreciation that it's not many things can be a conduit, a wormhole for a really profound relief. And that relief is not, you could say, the result of some kind of tautology or some kind of solution. It's not. It's out beyond that. The relief is out beyond what one could expect to discover through an explanation or a tautology of some kind, or, you know, spiritual logic applied. You don't need anyone's advice. You don't need to give anyone any advice.
Yeah, I was just reflecting on this probably this morning and yesterday, but there's still this behavior of going back, being curious, looking for answers in the various words of the books, the various books.
Captivation. It's a nice way. It's a nice way to, you know, kill time.
That's a little annoying and frustrating too, though.
Well, then you're lucky. You're lucky. Yeah, when you see that captivation is not giving you the same nachas, to use the Yiddish word, as it once did, is a great sign, because it's like, now what?
Nice try.
it's forcing you into a kind of a, let's say, a tighter corner.
Yeah.
And that's how this, you know, relieves itself of itself. That's how we, you could say, exhaust the, you know, strategies and the entanglement with captivation. Because as long as we're being entertained by captivation, we'll return to it for whatever dividends we get from it. If, as you just suggested, the dividends are starting to fail, the internal rate of return is about as good as you can get from a savings bank, well, maybe you decide to put your cash elsewhere. And that would be, you know, that elsewhere would be exactly this. Mm-hmm. Follow the vibe. Reality, were there one, is what is revealed as we wean ourselves from captivation, discover that the vibe is what's present behind all, you know, word and interpretive forms, and then learn how to take up residence in the vibe. It's a lovely, you know, depthful intelligence.
It seems as though it takes a running leap to do that, because if you stick your toe in it, you know, it doesn't really doesn't work. It's not really a halfway measure, it seems to me.
And it takes a lifetime of those halfway measures, you know, to be somehow curiously prepared to, you know, whatever it means to, I don't know, hang with the vibe with less distraction, right? It's kind of a distraction game, and that's why so many of the yogas emphasize, you know, mindfulness and, you know, whether it's Ajna Chakra meditation or jhanic meditation, they're all instilling, call it practical, you know, sensual practices of concentration. Stability of attention. And that's cool. They all contribute. There's no question about it. They contribute. But then as you see that, whoa, it's not really necessary to stabilize. That the vibe just, like a tractor beam, you know, informs you of its, let's say, its own intelligence. You don't have to lend a hand by, you know, attempting your hand at one pointed concentration.
This is sort of a wacky question, but do you think that there's a state, you know, like a waking state, a dreamless state, or some combination, a dreaming state, you know, some inner, it seems to me that transitional periods are the most useful. As far as not being so attached to any kind of a narrative going on. Although, I mean...
Sure.
I say that because there's even narratives then too, but sometimes there's not. I mean, culpable, you know.
If you're in a mood to attend to some kind of contemplative engagement, then choose one or just fall into one that, you know, somehow pleases you.
Yeah.
And that is not anathema to or at odds with the, you know, ongoing weaning oneself from captivation.
Well, I noticed the captivation all the way through. You know, I mean, certainly I can be stressed out, and the dream state will be reflecting the same kinds of stress in different mm-hmm. forms, you know. Mm-hmm.
Sure.
But, you know, there's no break.
Yeah. Content and association is of that nature. Content and association is sticky. And so it, you know, it vibrates in such a way that it kind of attracts or foments more of same. And some called present experience, if it's not under the influence of captivation or allegory, metaphor, virtuality, daydreaming, is remarkably relaxed from all of that implication. Or the need to resolve anything.
I must have missed that first word. I thought it was captivation. Was it?
Mm-hmm. I guess.
Are you saying there can be a pure captivation?
This is always this. It's always pure. It's always unadorned.
Yet there is captivation by rather mundane things.
Well, again, captivation itself is a myth, and everything that appears as or in captivation is also, you know, kind of a curiously reverberating myth. It's not actually ever captivated or distracted from itself. It can only, you know, appear to be. The muggle is just swept away by captivation. And the wizard starts to see through the implication of captivation. And the, you know, the arising of one's innate intelligence has nothing to say. Maybe it's because it has nothing to say that it's comfortable just saying anything. It's not beholding to nothing to say, because it has, you know, because it's become more intimately aware of its own emptiness. It's, you know, able to be, let's say, more functionally lucid.
Yeah.